Om Jnanatimirandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Dhena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namah.
And so Srila Bhaktisiddhanta called that devotee in, and he said, okay, so I'm restationing you to another place.
So that's like
and he said, okay, Guru Maharaj, whatever you say, I'll go anywhere. And then he said, okay, you can stay. And he just wanted to show everybody that actually he wasn't attached to the particular project, just to the service itself, the principle of service applies everywhere. So it's really nice what you're doing.
I would say
Mulakar. Mulakar. Mulakarada.
Karana.
Yes. Mulakarana. The root cause. The root cause. Mulakarana.
Since Jude's been living in the ashram.
Jude?
Yeah.
Okay.
He's also been helping support the ashram.
Is that right? What do you do to support the ashram?
I currently work as an instrumentation and electrical supervisor in a chemical plant.
Oh, nice. So what kind of training did you have to get such a job?
I was in the military and then just a lot of on-the-job training throughout my career so far.
What branch of the military?
Navy.
Oh, Navy. Where were you stationed?
Japan.
Cusco?
Yes.
Nice.
You've been?
Yeah, I go to Japan twice a year.
Oh,
yes,
nice.
I don't know, but...
That's
wrong. Nihongo ga wakarimasu ka? Just had a check. Nice service you're doing. Really nice.
One time.
It's real teamwork.
Hare
Krishna, Gaurabhati.
When the foundations are very big,
one cycle
and a lot of sacrificial service, actually. Met the devotees in New Zealand, and then she's from Chicago. Met the devotees in New Zealand, came back here. She's so many books.
What's your technique? And what your realization? Why you're so enthusiastic about distributing books? You mean like how?
He tried yoga and meditation.
You two would go out together a lot.
Yeah. She's really enthusiastic.
No one wanted to leave India.
Distribution, so.
Or if they even tried, they didn't have the hope to see
another person.
Do anything if they left.
Like always pushing to do that.
What do you like best about book distribution?
And as long as that is never lost,
I like when I have like a nice connection. Especially if they're coming to Montreal, you see them come to a program.
You never stop and make sure the next generation understands.
You can kind of see like something is kind of like opening in their hearts.
Yeah.
So like that kind of
changes the world.
To be instrumental in that is it's a powerful realization of Krishna's mercy, isn't it? Be an instrument.
Yeah, and if you're more connected to
religious spirit,
I feel more connected to like my spiritual master.
That's how communism fell.
Yeah, you just feel it.
Even before it fell, you predicted that's how it would fall.
Like starting to get to it and
be
interested in it.
Yeah.
Man-made intent of godlessness. It couldn't stand
enthusiastic and serious.
Systems were.
What would you say is the hardest a part of your service of distributing books?
And what will make the people bring it down is sankirtan jagya.
Sometimes maintaining enthusiasm, even when there's no direct recognition for yourself.
They understand the way history truly works. They will look this period.
There's no one like laying out like a carpet for you, anything like that. So, kind of having that like self-motivation to
do that. Yeah,
sometimes
that
can
be difficult.
I think when you get too much on like the mental platform of wanting recognition,
want to make sure that
appreciation for standing for somebody else.
Generation after generation.
It's powerful that I really appreciate your realizations, because then that examining one's own motives, why am I doing this and what's keeping me going, is economic collapse. It's very revealing, isn't it? It's like knowing what's motivating me. 10,000 years for the service is very powerful. That's what makes it go.
You have times where you don't have those sweet interactions, and you just the books aren't going out, and then giving up and dying. So you don't have that same kind of sense to keep doing it.
For a period of time, I was in a situation where I had to go out alone every day for a while. That was maybe more than several years. I was, I had moved to the San Francisco area to be near the San Francisco airport, because we had a spot there. And the two other devotees I was working with gradually went other places, and I was left alone. So I kept going out, but I developed a system when I was by myself so that I keep my mind fixed. Should I say what it is?
Yes.
I made this little chart. Because at the time I was working behind a booth. They gave us a booth in the airport. And I made a chart, and I on the chart there was a grid that showed all the possible scenarios of interactions with people. Generally. I mean, there were six altogether. And like the first one was that I'd wave to them or whatever, and they would ignore me. That was one. The next one was I waved to them and that they'd acknowledge me, but they keep walking. The third was they acknowledge me and then come over, and then they walk away. The fourth was they come over, acknowledge me, and then they would give a donation and take a book. The fifth was they come over, acknowledge me, take the book and give a huge donation. And then the sixth was they acknowledge, and then they'd want to have more information and more context. So I had this spectrum. And so when I was out by myself, then whatever anybody did, I counted it as equal. So if they ignored me, I'd say, okay, that's the same as this, this side or that side. It's all just filling in the grid. And I kept them every day, and I had them in a little folder. And I just look at it and I say, all I'm going to do is fill in the grid. And I don't expect a person. And I heard a quote from Rachel Maddow. She's on MSNBC. She's one of the commentators there. And she said, it was in regard to public speaking, but she said, you won't be effective if you're expecting a specific result. Don't expect a specific result. The mind, if you generalize everything and just say it's all service, and whatever happens, I count it as the same. Whether they ignore me or they give a big donation and join the mantra lounge or whatever, it's all just all the parts have to be there. And the other thing I noticed, it was very enlivening, is no matter what happened over a week, it would always fill out the same. There's some ups and downs, but ultimately there was all the same interactions. You could add them up and say that these things are going to happen. So looking at it in a broader spectrum, you can see over a longer period of time, you should have more information. There's a law in research about how the longer you do an experiment, the more the data shows the actual natural result. It comes to, I forget what it's called, it's a convenient name or something like that. Law of evidence. There's one called the law of large numbers, too. It's a similar thing.
This is
math. This is nice. Gaura Bhakti. And Mulakarna Gaura Bhakti. And Michael and Sean and Jude and Jack.
Lauren,
nice to meet you, Lauren.
Where did you meet?
Which place?
And they kept bumping into each other a few times. she's been a complete that our concept of being bubble of energy, like, tell me what to do. Actually, I'll do it anyway. She's like, she actually studied marketing, and she's been working on marketing.
Oh, really?
And she was working in the city of Philadelphia, marketing for them. And then she's coming from dance business, and then she literally heard from devotees when she really wanted to. And as soon as she goes, she started coming back for long. She's just been coming nonstop.
What was the impetus, like, when you heard about devotees? Is there anything you can describe, that, like, the internal feeling of what attracted you?
I was actually on South Street buying fabric for a sewing class because I was depressed. But not like a depression, but just kind of like a depressed state. What is the more? Is there a more? Is this just the it? And so I was like, well, there's only one last month of this skill. And that's when I ran into Peter. And then she gave me the book written by Deborah Winterswamy, Patty on Network. Like, this is what I've been looking for, oh my god! So she was like, come to Mantra Lounge on Friday, he'll be speaking. And so I finished the Nuts Happiness on Friday. I met her on Wednesday, finished before Friday, and started reading Peter because the Nuts Happiness explains why the Peter is so important. So I was like, oh, I gotta read this book. And then I went to meet Deborah Winterswamy, and I was like, this is what I've been looking for. So that's why I just throw myself into it. So it's like, if this is the path, I'll just do one
more. Amazing.
Is
that right? Wow. What do your parents do?
My mom is an emergency veterinarian, and my dad is a serial entrepreneur.
A serial entrepreneur. Nice. Very good. You know, marketing. I was talking, we had a seminar here over the weekend, and one of the aspects of the seminar I talked about spiritual entrepreneurialism, and how Lord Chaitanya and Lord Nirananda are said to have opened a marketplace. And I was talking about how marketing has quantitative and qualitative reasoning skills required to be successful, and how it's a very all-encompassing meditation to market the Sankirtan movement. And it's really, if you look through the way Prabhupada presented the practice of Krishna consciousness, it's actually one of the practices of Krishna consciousness is to be absorbed in that idea of marketing. In fact, in the Upadeshamrita, when Srila Prabhupada is describing the topmost devotee of those, not that necessarily descend from the spiritual world, but who rise up from the practice of sadhana, chanting, following the process, said that the one on the topmost level is very steady in sadhana, but is also absorbed in thinking how to market the Sankirtan movement. That's one of the meditations. You know, so when we talk about meditation, Krishna, part of that meditation is really thinking how to spread it. Nice to meet you.
In the little time she's been around, she's been already doing marketing the distribution, natural edit, gets into the van, check, and just go with a bunch of things and distribute to people. Don't know how they do it. And she's saying with books, she's natural. She's telling people to take seconds and sell it. That's just me. She's very natural. She's already done about the marketing graph and everything else so quickly. She's just been coming for like 2 months. So much already done.
Well done. Thanks. Welcome. From the old days.
A 17th birthday was done in your presence.
Yeah, I remember that. There was some sweet times back in that building above the
Indian
restaurant.
With all the rats.
Yeah. I was never introduced. I think you kept that part quiet.
We just tried to stop them. Oh, so you didn't hear them in the
water. Oh, that was nothing.
Just a little. So she's been here from the beginning. She moved from Canada just to help with the preteens to study there. She'll do whatever is required, kirtan, book distribution, prasad distribution, cooking, anything. It's always, yes, I'll do it. And a lot of people should like her, like she'll cultivate people like that too. So young and sitting in the streets, 21 years old, and does so much service. I don't know what I was doing, I was at 8 to 10. Steadily throughout the wishes. Mm-hmm.
From the very beginning, steady.
Anything that you ask that which is
that's one of the most valuable attitudes in a volunteer organization. It's not having a feeling of entitlement, but you know, being ready to do the needful. Probably used to call it doing the needful. And having just when you were mentioning the rats, one time I asked Radhanath Swami, I said, tell me about like show fighting and how you got started. I said, I don't want to hear about the successes. I want to hear about all the bad stuff. Because sometimes it's overbearing, you know, spreading the Sankirtan movement is, it takes a lot of austerity as far as just dealing with everyday kind of problems. Everything that can go sideways does eventually. And it's part of being a Goshtinandi, like doing outreach, is you have to, that's our austerity. And remembering how it was, you know, when one first started and all the challenges and stuff.
She would sit for breakfast and a big rat would just come down the stairs. She's like, oh, you're here too. Previous place where we went. Now it's not like that.
And no problem staying in America?
Not anymore until 2020.
Until 2020, you're good.
Yeah. Nice.
It's great to see you again.
Govinda.
Hare Krishna, Gita Govinda.
She finished her PhD in Toronto. And she went...
In what?
Psychology. She's practicing as a psychologist. Then she went to Rishikesh for yoga teacher training. And on the last day of the yoga teacher training, she heard Radhanath Maharaj do kirtan. Came back to Toronto and Googled Toronto kirtan. Came to Bhakti Lounge. And a few weeks later... And she had like a really nice apartment. And a few weeks later,
she didn't with the rats.
Yeah. And she wouldn't move. I said, I don't think this is a good place for you. And she just spread out on the floor. I'm not in this place. Please move it. And she's been here since then. She actually was about to go for a Vipassana retreat. She dropped it to come to Gitanagari. She already paid $900 for it.
Wow.
Dropped it to come. And then a few weeks later, gave all her savings to Matrimon, like everything she had. Like just one day on Sankirtan. I think I have this much money, I'm going to transfer it. She squared it on the book, on the machine that she's taking money from people. She squared her savings into, I don't know, she's given everything.
So you had a really big day.
and then in the building also, like, whatever is required, she will distribute, like, minimum 100, some books like that, you know, just anything, anybody. Nobody can say no to her when she stopped. And then in Philly, not only was she doing book distribution, but she was also doing a job as a psychology professor at Penn State. She was doing that job just to pay for mantra launch rent. So all these girls have sacrificed so much. Like, she took up a job she didn't want to work, but she did that. She'd drive all the way to Penn State, do the work a couple of days, and come back to Philly, and the rest of the day just distribute books. And now, like, she just doesn't want to work. Although she has offers, she just wants to do full-time book distribution. So indebted to everything she's done.
So that, with that kirtan you heard up in Rishikesh, was that the first contact you had with Hare Krishna devotees?
Yes. Yeah.
Was it in a hall or something like that?
Was I in a hall?
What was it in a hall?
In a hall, yes. It was just in a place where we were practicing yoga. Had a speaker coming in, Vedanta players.
How was it that Radhanath Maharaj was there? Was that orchestrated? It was an outreach program?
Yeah, we had heard about it, and Maharaj was, I think Prabhu was also distributing books.
Yeah. Which place? Which vacantus?
In Rishikesh? The Nanfash Ashrams?
Yeah. He's a yoga teacher, married Canadian lady, I think.
Yes.
And he's got a place in Rishikesh and a place in Canada. So we do their programs every time we go. Maharaj is good friends with him.
Well, now see what you did. You're doing a perfectly good PhD career in psychology. Nice. Huge assets. Probably used to always talk about how the assets we gain in the material world are like zeros. Because ultimately, although they're praiseworthy in some respect, at the end, you really move on from all those. At the end, meaning the end of the body and so forth, you move on to that, go somewhere else, and you really start over. but he said that when you put a one in front of the zeros, then it becomes even more valuable. So Robert always wanted that, you know, very highly educated people, people with great qualifications to come, and then when you add Krishna to it, then it's even more effective. We've seen that before, so it's really powerful to have that, you know, have all that training and be able to present those credentials and preach Krishna consciousness.
And it's also hard, like, if she gets good job offers from the university, she has to kind of do book distribution. Her first book distribution was at the Pride Parade. Couldn't have been more intense than that.
Yeah.
And hundreds of thousands of people just going for it. I think Prabhu was there, he was teaching us book distribution. So we were just standing next to him and she started, and Prabhu was there, you know?
So, yeah. Nice. Well done. Jack. Gita Govinda, Sachi, Lauren, and go this way. Jude, Sean, Michael, Mulakarna, then Gora Bhakti, Lauren, Sachi, Gita Govinda, Mangalore, Jack. Okay, got it. And so, what is the scheme for your book distribution these days? What kind of ways are you tracking, and you know, what kind of ideas have you been working upon?
So we try everything that we follow and follow the same strategy, but the way we are implementing it is so summertime is different, and the rest of the year is a lot focused on universities. A bunch of universities, we have spots mapped out in Philadelphia, we know which spots were. There's quite a bit of them. So just during the day, Monday to Friday, it's like street sankirtan from about 11 to 5. And then Tuesday to Friday, Monday we just clean up the ashram. And Saturday, Sunday is festival time, like there's sankirtan festivals going on. So we try to book festivals. One thing, again, Gita Govinda and Guru Bhakti have been doing work on it, is that we've got a database from month to month. Whichever big festivals are happening, like if there's Oktoberfest happening, or there's some other festivals happening, Pride Parade, anything. And we try to negotiate deals with the festivals.
Mm.
We'll tell them, oh, well, we can give you face painting. Like, Jude's first service was face painting the festival. He was face painting kids, in return of which we got a free table. What festival was that?
I like that. That's
Caribbean
really
festival.
Nice innovation.
Yeah, so we just, you know, it's a really interesting picture of kids. But they're free, so they can't complain.
cats.
Jude's first was face painting. Sean's done face painting at one festival.
No kids showed up.
We recently got into Comic Con, Wizard World, because we offered to do face painting for them. And then sometimes they'll say, oh, we can offer you free meditation program, so we'll just do kirtan for an hour.
That's
and then
good.
Give us a free table.
Wow.
So we take that off for them.
That's really smart. I like that.
Wow.
So we try to negotiate a lot of trades with different festivals,
like that,
to get a free book table.
Yeah.
And we were trying prasad table and book table, but I don't think we have the manpower right now for prasad table at a festival. We tried two festivals, we were burnt out. And it totally took away from book distribution, so we stopped doing that.
That can happen when you get mission creep. And is it this specific focus and energy doing the book distribution? You bring in a few more elements, and the next thing you know. And I mean, one of the worst things that can happen too is that you get successful at something else too.
Yeah.
I mean, that's happened in ISKCON in the past, that, well, let's just introduce this, you know, and that'll support the book distribution. And the next thing you know, all the energy starts going that
way. That's all there is.
Because everyone goes, yeah, that's all there is. I mean, so there's a very deliberateness to keeping to the book distribution as, you know, it's a sadhana. Nice.
So we do that, and we haven't done much door-to-door sankirtan, considering the environment in Philadelphia right now. We haven't had much luck. Sometimes people will show kind of We haven't been successful with door to door at all, so maybe when you come we can run for you, because it's not super safe. We've had all kind of security.
But you know what's better than door to door? Is store to store. And yeah, that's not scary.
Yeah.
The thing about door to door is your timing is everything. Because you got to be there when it's not everything, but it really makes a big difference. If you go when people are not home, then it's frustrating because a lot of people don't answer, or because they're not there, or then, I mean, the percentages go way down, you waste time.
Yeah.
But shop to shop.
Yeah.
You did that?
Yeah. What we do is, I mean, the city, we've fried out all shopkeepers, so we can't talk to them anymore. But what we've done is, we've made traveling Sankirtan loops, like some routes.
Yeah.
So what we do is, well, especially during the marathon, because the university is closed and you have to do the books if you didn't know what to do. So that's when, like, the 20% explore thing we tried to do. And worked, actually. We did a lot of books easily. What we did was we mapped the strip malls and, like, say, from Philadelphia to Westchester. We mapped the strip malls, small, like, Whole Foods, whatever came on the way. And then we just drove, like, Michael drove. Gurbakti and I were on the car, for example, the first day. We just get off at a strip mall, do books for half an hour, just have a goal. Every time, I think the most thing that worked for us is having a goal. So we'll do 40 books at every stop, and we just do 40 books, just get it back to the car and move. It was so cool, it just really helped us keeping the pace. 40 books, do it, get out, do it. So before somebody caught up with us, we could go from shop to shop and do it there. So that was one place where we did have success with shop to shop. And also, like, in outskirts.
And walking in, right?
Outskirts of Philadelphia, we have nothing like that. Because there's nobody on the strip, like Ardmore, different places like that. There's nobody there, so we have to go from shop to shop. And they don't see us often enough, so they're not, like, they don't remember us.
Yeah.
So they'll let us go in. But in Philly.
Have you actually found that there's a saturation of the shop to shop? You mentioned, you know, you burned them out or something.
Yeah, I think so, but you can check it out, but, like, in some places when we go often enough, they know us.
I see.
What we are having luck with shop to shop is with the shop distribution.
Oh.
So for around Mantra Lounge, an area like Sean and Lauren and Sachi, we just go from places and, like, if you want a lunch today, they're like, yeah, you bring your lunch. So it's happening there because they want the lunch every time.
They give donation for the lunch?
Yeah.
Oh.
So
I didn't know you were doing that. So how much are the lunches?
$6.
$6. So you just walk in and take orders in the shop, and then they come back bring the lunch.
Yeah, we haven't started advertising yet. We're working on the draft.
You got a scheme.
University is building university prashad, and it's what we're noticing in the university is that kids are getting books. Maybe you have some story to tell. Like, from they're getting books and prashad both, and it's going well together. But we've limited it to 2 days because you don't want it to take away from book distribution. At the same time, it's creating opportunity for some service for those who are new. Someone has a service to wash dishes and they have a service otherwise. So we're experimenting with that.
Nice.
What do you think, Prabhu, about that?
About the prashad distribution?
Yeah, like, I was wanting to ask you that question, that it's always a doubt in my mind, like, book distributions.
I think it, you know, keeping it limited. I know prasad, there's a balance there. Any prasad distribution program is very labor intensive. Like, if you have a full-time restaurant, you know, any new people get thrown into the chop and dice line, you know. And it's hard to get them trained up on book distribution and stuff like that. At the same time, you know, it's part of the balance that we have with distributing prasadam and books. It really attracts people and makes people really friendly. So my feeling is that it's nice to have it as part of your program. It, in the eyes of people in general, it legitimizes your program. Anytime you feed living entities, they like you. if you got some nice food, you know, they're like, oh, those are people with the food. Even animals, you know, it's like, here, boy, Kate was like, okay, I like you. So I think it's nice to have as part.
Your program is very successful. And what you just said about feed the animals, so Phil.
who owns the dog grooming location. He's a friend of mine.
Oh my
he
gosh.
He moves food from
Seven.
New York two times a year.
Yeah.
And he always posts it on Facebook.
Really?
He always mentions you.
Oh my gosh.
He just says pet food. Like dog food.
Yeah, the food trap, you know?
I mean, you used to.
He's a dog grooming.
This was one question I wanted to ask you the whole time. It was on weighing on my mind that am I sidetracking or am I creating?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with your motivation. Mm-hmm. And I really liked what you said about how it creates a niche of service for some people to, you know, wash dishes and, you know, prepare and things like that. But I think the word is limited.
Okay.
You know, just so it's balanced.
Yeah.
It's a part of your program, but it doesn't become the main program.
Right.
The main thing is to keep the main thing the main thing.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for it.
There's a book fair in my town on October 13th and 14th, and I know the woman who's running it. I could connect and see if she would let me go to a book fair.
She knows everybody.
And Doyle's dad. It's an outdoor book fair.
Well, this is, I would say, one of the, or maybe the most successful programs in North America.
Evo.
The way, you know, and I really like that it's keeping the focus on the devotees, how to cultivate devotees, train devotees, take care of new people, and then the engagement is book distribution. To me, this is an ideal program. So often, devotees have the idea that, you know, let's build something, buy something huge, and then they get encumbered by that, and then they can't take care of devotees as much, and then they, you know, have to do something else besides depend on book distribution and things like that. So it's, our experience at ISV has always been stick with the main basic thing and let it grow from there. I read a letter Prabhupada wrote, and he said, grow slow. He said, don't try to grow fast. You can't do it. It becomes artificial. But if you grow slow and depend on developing deep relationships and training devotees and having them have a taste for hearing and chanting and distribution of transcendental literature, then it's a formula for long-term success. And that's what you're getting. It's really good.
We get to hear
this. Yeah, we all do, because it's, you know, it's a Prabhupada would describe it as a war that we're in with Maya. And in fact, he would, when he'd sign his letters, there is a military context. But at the end, or at the beginning, he'd say, camp such and such. like the military encampment. And he would use that nomenclature to describe how we're fighting the war with Maya. Even sometimes we would lose soldiers, he would say. You know, and that's natural in a battle. It's not desirable at all, but it's something that happens. And it's a real fight. You know, you can see even the great acharyas like Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. He had, you know, had to fight vigorously for his institution, even for his life sometimes. They tried to assassinate him. And Srila Prabhupada, I mean, everybody knows his life story and all the things that he's been up against. And it's not going to change because we're basically in a foreign environment in general, presenting Krishna consciousness. And making a stand here is something that Mahaprabhu notices, and he gave the order, you know, do this, make a stand. So whatever the yogis do, by going to the Himalaya and they'll sit in cold water during the winter time up to the neck, you've read about this, or sit in a hot fire in the summer just to learn detachment, that we get as Goshtiyanandis by dealing with, you know, everything we have to deal with. You know, because everybody brings along a physical body, and then there's the whole you know, subtle body with all its various complications, right? And then all those things, and to hold together a team that's successful year after year in working together, hearing and chanting together, and distributing. Yes, it's a major feat.
Trying to work this way and that.
We're just talking to them the other day about all the different financial considerations and things like that, and all that is still part of the energy, the internal energy, trying to work it all out. But just be methodical and dispassionate and always make the choice based on you know, what your mission is and what's best for service.
It totally puts focus back.
What time is it now?
Right now,
9:52.
10 to 10.
9:52. But we got all day.
Yeah.
I know there's been some times when I can't take it for granted, or I think the service will always be there, and then I don't like recognize what it is that. I don't recognize like the like how much mercy I'm getting by like going on this, and just wondering how to always be grateful for the service when you're doing it every day, and it's a regular service, and I don't get familiar with it, I guess.
Well, one thing I read in the 11th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam when Krishna's teaching Uddhava, he talks about how to not take a mantra for granted. Because we get a mantra and we can chant it every day and become familiar with it and say, it's just, you know, it's just a mantra. But he said that to not take a mantra for granted, you have to study it. And when you study a mantra, for instance, say if you read something about the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, and you'll notice that just afterwards, you have a lot more interest in it. Remember, this is rare and valuable. What I'm doing. So, you know, keeping as a study, you know, looking at what you're actually doing and remembering from the point of view of what's that, you know, analyzing what are we actually doing out there, what's taking place. I had an experience going to some other countries like Vietnam and even outside America, anywhere where there's not freedom of speech laws. Getting moved along and thinking, hey, they can't do that. And they'll go, oh, yeah, they can do whatever they want. They can throw you in jail forever if they want to. And then remembering, a lot of times when I come back to America, like even in Japan, I go to Japan twice a year and do Sankirtan there. And for the most part, it's fairly free, but, you know, it's not as free as, you know, New York or Philadelphia for sure. And so I was trying to bring my mind to, you know, just analyze and look and see. How do you do it, Navina? Not take for granted Sankirtan. Because Gita Govinda is going out regularly, and then she's saying that how is it that you stay fresh and remember like the value of the service that you're doing?
It
for me, it's a lot about just sense of identity. Who am I? Who am I? So it's not just something that I happen to do at some point, but it's just my nature. It's just who I am. And then it becomes much more convincing and natural and authentic. So to me, it's a lot about just living it in all my aspects of life. So it's like drinking water or eating prasadam. It's just a life necessity. Otherwise, I can't live. I just need this. Otherwise, I go crazy. Like a guy who's, you know, somebody who's got a condition, they just know, if I don't take my medicine or if I don't do this or do that, well, I just self-destruct. I won't be here for long. So then it takes on a different dimension than just something that we happen to do at some point. And then whatever you need in order to do what you have to do to stay alive and sane, you just do that, and you don't get all worked up about it. Oh, why do I need a little extra sleep? Why do I have to do some yoga? Or why do I, you know, like we all have requirements. I talked to a devotee yesterday who was feeling like a little too much pressure that he puts on himself and maybe he perceives others put on him. He said, you just have to figure out how much communication, how much social life, how much recreation, how much rest, what do you need in order to stay functional? Because this is your life, this is your service, you know, like you're in the army or you're a sports person or you're in business. You optimize your life in order to achieve your objective. And the other things just are subservient to your purpose, to your goal. So that takes different aspects. For me, it's very helpful to just associate with people like Vaisheshi Prabhu who are balanced, who are like, you know, they're not just, oh, this is keeping the main thing also means understanding the other things that are related to it and what importance they have and how much of the other stuff do I also need in order to keep the main thing. Otherwise, the main thing won't really go on for very long. So everybody's in person and we have our needs. But then I've seen how through this focus on Sankirtan, the other things actually fall in place. They find their spot, their slot, so to speak. And that's it's a refinement process. Don't expect it to happen overnight. Sometimes you go a little too much this way, a little too much that way, but just going forward.
Does that help?
Yeah. Sorry, I'm very nervous.
Mulukarna.
Yes. I thank you so much for everyone's support to me. I think I, you know, could be working today, but I wasn't. You know, I worked yesterday. So, and then when Mangai told us 2 days ago, 3 days ago on our WhatsApp, you know, we are going Sunday to inspire people. I was like, going crazy. I was like looking forward to, you know, hearing from you and meeting devotees and stuff like that. So, I'm so excited. But my question is like, I really want this really bad, like wanting to be good again, you know, like I feel really fallen, like I really want to be a devotee. So how do I make sure that I'm trying to be like Krishna conscious every moment, like not wasting my time, especially I'm like much older, you know, like I feel like I don't have much time, we only live like 100 years old, you know. And Prabhu was saying in the lecture really, really like resonated with me. He was saying like to the ability to hear depends on your service attitude. You know, how do I, you know, make sure my attitude is, you know, in the Krishna conscious way and, you know, like that. And I actually been thinking of this for a really, really long time, you know. And I have prayed to Krishna like, you know, please help me, like, I really want to do this. Sankirtan is so nice, helping people, you know, everyone go back to Krishna like that. But I shouldn't approach Krishna directly. So, and all of you devotees are here, and oh my God, you know, you guys are so inspiring. You like, you know, help so much people. just wondering if you could give us your blessing, you know, like, so we can do this forever, you know. You know, as long as we're breathing, you know, it's like, you know, like, as I don't know what everybody wants. This is really what I want, you know. Like, I'm just like, I'm sorry, I'm just so excited right now.
Sorry. Not at all.
So how do
it's
I
good
my
to be
attitude?
Excited, you know, because it is exciting. Is when, you know, when the soul realizes that I'm not actually part of the material world, it's invigorating, to say the least, realization, and it's very exciting to realize that Krishna is extending himself, and that he'll facilitate, you know, whatever my desire is. In the Gita, he goes out of his way to express that again and again, you know, I'm laying out the way the world works, but I'm here. And if you want me, then just really try for it, and I'll facilitate. I'll bring everything that you need. And we were talking in the seminar about how Advaita Acharya had called out to bring Lord Chaitanya to the world. And we looked at a picture of him, and we were meditating on what was his feeling when he was doing that. And it was kind of a feeling of helplessness, that how can I do this service? And he was making loud cries, and he also looked in the scripture to find out ways that Krishna would be attracted. And he found the verse that said, if you offer Ganges water and Tulsi, then Krishna sells himself to the devotees. I thought, aha, I'll use this, and I'll use whatever I can. But mostly it was the loud cries, sincere cries. So Prabhupada once told us, and this was in the context of book distribution, actually. It was 1975 in Vrindavan. There were two parties. I mean, there were two schools of thought at the time. There was one devotee, Tripurari Maharaj. He had just taken sannyas in 1975. And then there was another devotee, Agopa Vrindapal. He had his idea of how book distribution should go on and the way we should present it. Tripurari had his idea, so he brought it to Prabhupada and for his answers. And a lot of it was how we should be training devotees to do book distribution, to be balanced and so forth. And Prabhupada stuck with very basic principles in his answers. He said, teach the devotees to be sincere. He said, because if they're sincere, then he pointed like this to his heart, then the master within the heart will show them what to do. He'll personally train them, he said. I thought about that, you know, what is sincerity? It's the most valuable substance you can get for any living being. And sometimes in chanting japa, I'm thinking like, okay, now it's time to try to find my sincerity if I have any. You know, it's like mining or something, like, you know, being lowered down by rope into one of those caves, you know, where you can start mining and see if there's anything down in there. You're going into dark regions, further down. Like, if I can come back from that excursion with, you know, one drop of sincerity, if I can find that in my own heart, locate it, then that's all attraction comes from that in spiritual life. It's that Krishna, if you can identify that feeling in your heart, that Krishna, I actually want to surrender to you. You know, he says it in the Gita, surrender to me. And then if you can find that, yeah, I actually want to do that. This, no matter what obstacle is there, this is what I really want. This is like a connection with your sincerity. And when Krishna sees that, to him, it's more valuable than anything else that you can do. And if you can keep focusing on that again and again, like, what is my sincere desire to surrender to Krishna? Then, you know, I always say this, there's a shop in Old Delhi. It's Old Delhi, Chandni Chowk. It's a really rough and tumble kind of place. It's always jammed full of rickshaws and just teeming with people everywhere. All these little shops, some have been there for hundreds of years. There's a little shop called Gulab Singh. A lot of devotees buy their oils there. He has fine oils. It's a family business. It's just a little hole in the wall, but he's got the best stuff. I mean, even Chanel and some big companies come there and they'll buy little vials for $50,000, $100,000, $200,000 to add to, you know, in their factory work. And so I thought about, you know, because sometimes people, even devotees, will buy really fine oil there and then boast, you know, it's like, see this? This cost me $500. You know, I'm offering my deities every day. Thinking, yeah, but what if he could find back in there a little bottle this big of sincerity? How much would that be worth? And that's the most valuable substance that anybody could get anywhere, is your own sincerity. And if you just find that feeling that, Krishna, I agree. Whatever you say, I agree. And especially the surrender part, I'm in. I'm signing the list. There's a little list you can sign up on. It has a box, you know, that says, surrender, no surrender. Say, okay, I'm checking this box. I surrender. I'm all in. And even if you can't do it yet, even if you're not to that point, can I have a Gita? If you're not to the point where you can actually do it, if you have that intention in your heart and you can identify it and you can revisit it when you need to, then you'll get that great inspiration. I just read this purport because it's kind of to the point. This is from 331. And here Krishna's saying that if you just follow my instructions, everything's going to be okay. And if you don't, then good luck. 331. Ye me matam idam nityam anutishtanti mahanava. Shata vanto nasuyanto muchante pi tepi karmavi. Those who execute their duties according to my injunctions and who follow this teaching faithfully without envy become free from the bondage of fruitive actions. Purport. The injunction of the Supreme Personality of Godhead Krishna is the essence of all Vedic wisdom and therefore is eternally true without exception. That's very powerful because to be successful in any discipline, you have to have a sense of confidence that I'm doing the right thing. We have to sense that the main thing, this is the main thing for me. And for us, our axiomatic truth comes from the Shastra, that we believe it unconditionally. And it's not unreasonable. In any science, in any study, in any discipline, you have to have that sense somewhere where you're not going to retreat beyond that. There has to be self-evident knowledge, self-effulgent, self-revealing knowledge that you accept. So we can triangulate and come to even an intellectual understanding of why the Bhagavad Gita is Krishna's word and that it's completely perfect and I'll just accept it. So that's important. And then he goes on, as the Vedas are eternal, so this truth of Krishna consciousness is also eternal. One should have firm faith in this injunction without envying the Lord. There are many philosophers who write comments on the Bhagavad Gita but have no faith in Krishna. They will never be liberated from the bondage of fruitive action. But an ordinary man with firm faith in the eternal injunctions of the Lord, even though unable to execute such orders, becomes liberated from the bondage of the law of karma. In the beginning of Krishna consciousness, one may not fully discharge the injunctions of the Lord, but because one is not resentful of this principle and works sincerely without consideration of defeat and hopelessness, he will surely be promoted to the stage of pure Krishna consciousness. And most people resonate with this idea of knowing that this is what I want to do, but not being able to do it fully. But Krishna knows our inner intention. Naveena Prabhu brought it up in the class about Krishna's rasa graha janardana, grahi janardana, bhava grahi janardana, and that he knows what our intention is deep in our heart. He knows that little spark of sincerity is there, so keep fanning it.
How do we cultivate the right intention for Krishna?
How do you get the right intention? How do you get
cultivate
sincerity?
The right proper intention and sincerity.
Well, one way that the general principle of the way you cultivate anything is by association. Because we are very much subject to mold our lives, or we're molded by our association. So we're a product of the association we keep. So when the devotees asked Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, what is a devotee? He said, Asat Sangha Tyage Vaishnavachar. A devotee is somebody who avoids bad association or gives it up altogether and then keeps good association. So even if you feel like I don't have any qualities, I'm lacking in all ways, if you have the intelligence to understand where somebody is, to identify somebody who does have good qualities, And then you agree, like, you go out of your way to serve them. Like, Navina Prabhu brought this up today also in his class about how if you serve somebody who has good qualities, then those qualities become available to you because their heart opens and it kind of comes out to you. So that's what Krishna says in the Gita, Tadvidi pranipatena pariprashnina sevaya upadakshanti te jnanam jnaninas tatvadarshina. Three key points, that when you find somebody that you see those qualities in, then you can go in and very humbly, like without any agenda, just submit yourself and render service. And then ask questions when you deserve to ask questions. Like, you've done some service, then that person's actually going to, you know, their heart's already open, and when you ask, they'll be really inclined to tell you what they've realized. It's almost like downloading information when you do it right. You know, you're just like, did you get the right plug? You know, it's like you plug it in and then it transfers the information from one to the next if the channel is open properly. Association is everything, really.
One was on a similar thing, but thinking about it for 2 days, it's we can be, maybe we read Prabhupada explains that, you know, if you're having a tough time or this or that, you render service with more enthusiasm while waiting for things to happen the way they have to happen. And we cultivate that attitude. But I was realizing in my own self that deep down in the heart, it might be some sort of like unwanted kind of, knot or bitterness or whatever. Oh, my life's really tough. Materially speaking, like the kind of, or it was very tough. Well, you know, that was a tough time. This was a tough time. And when you're trying to care for devotees, like, I'm noticing that it leaves some sort of a block. You're not able, you're caring, but you're not able to fully care because you have certain attitudes because of what you think was tough. And then you have these ideas, this is how to move past that. And is that a sign of being like some sort of not the right attitude for Krishna? Like some sort of, it feels like it's unwanted, I can't tell what it actually is, but I notice that it's a disturbance. If you could clarify it. I don't know if I made my question clear. Sorry.
Not super clear, but let me try answering the parts that I heard, and then you can ask a follow-up if you want. But just since this point about attitude has come up a couple times, it's something, first of all, Prabhupada mentions in the preface to the Upadeshamrita, where he says, advancement of the devotees on the path of devotional service is dependent on their attitude. And attitude is adjustable. It's one thing that can be done is that you can adjust your attitude from, it can be switched. And one of the attitudes that helps to overcome some of the hardness of heart that can be there from various experiences in this life or the last is gratitude. And it's a very powerful solvent, kind of a universal solvent that can be used to dissolve those kinds of bitter feelings or hardness of heart. And something that Shukadeva Goswami mentions at the beginning of his teachings to Maharaj Parikshit when he starts pointing to the various aspects of the universe and says, just try to see this, how this is a personal universe, that whatever kinds of assets are being extended to you are coming from a person. He personalizes the whole universe. In other words, he's showing that the fruit trees, for instance, they're extending their arms and they're offering fruits for free. I mean, so many that everybody gets some. Every living entity can feed off a nice tree for a long time. He says, so who thought of that? Where did it come from? And you know, he's saying it's coming from a person. There's personal intention behind the universe where all these things. And so it's something to be cultivated, the kind of gratitude, appreciating everything that we have, rather than looking at what we don't have, and feeling bad about what's taken place before, considering like everything I have now. It's one of the moods of the verse, this is a famous verse from the Bhagavatam, which describes the quintessential attitude of a devotee. And it's so important, this verse says, it's actually Brahma speaking, that if you can develop this attitude, then you're qualified to go back to Godhead. And the attitude is one of acceptance, that whatever is happening to me is coming by mercy. It's actually Krishna's arrangement, and even those reversals of fortune that have come to me, and even the penury I've experienced in my life, it's by Krishna's arrangement. You know, cultivating that, going deeply within it, makes one more and more qualified for going back to Godhead, what to speak of helping other people. Did that resemble an answer?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
The question here.
I was just curious, how important is book distribution, and how do you see book distribution benefiting the world?
I gave a little talk on Friday night over 26 Second Avenue, and some of the thoughts I've had about it, which I researched and then presented in a succinct way, but I think it has enough behind it to, you know, answer the question. Really, books have been instrumental in implanting ideologies within human societies since the beginning of writing. And even before that, you know, things were spoken and passed on. Humans tend to respond to symbolism, they tend to respond to well-organized ideas. And the best of those things come in books. I showed in the seminar how, for instance, one of the examples I gave was of the concept of natural selection and the idea that there's been evolution, that evolution of species is responsible for the varieties that we see in the world, the varieties of species. And so a person did a research project, wrote a thesis about it, and then took the trouble to bind it in a book and make it available, called The Origin of the Species. Most people don't have that book, but most people accept the idea of evolution. I mean, so many books you can read, self-help or anything else, and there'll be some paragraph in there that say, but of course, you know, we evolved to this level. We were like this before, and that's and that. And that's a fragment from that idea that was put in the book, that was presented in the book. And the seeds, the idea seeds that are in the book, they spill out into human society. And when they're well organized like that, they start to they grow, and people accept things like that. I gave a couple other examples about movements that started and persisted because of a written word. For instance, Fidel Castro's rise to power in Cuba was because of his compilation, even while he was in prison, of a book called History Wounds Ultimate. And that book got distributed. It was smuggled out of the prison, and it got distributed to the general mass of people in Cuba who were ready for revolution after reading it. The American Revolution was galvanized by Thomas Paine's best-selling book called
Common Sense.
It was even to date, it's the per capita the best-selling book of all times. He sold it in the colonies, and everybody bought a copy, and everybody read it. And according to, there's a wide consensus amongst historians that that's what sparked the American Revolution. So I give anecdotal evidence like this that books have staying power. They also inspire people in various ways. So the strategy of book distribution is not something sentimental. It's not just because some author wants to, you know, see his book sold, or something for us to do, a way to make money, you know. But it's actually a very reasonable strategy to inculcate our thoughts, our culture, into human society. And I also quoted from Joseph T. O'Connell, the late Joseph T. O'Connell, the preeminent academic scholar in Gaudiya Vaishnavism, in his paper called Institutionalizing Prema. He writes that in Gaudiya Vaishnavism, there are two institutions. And first of all, it's valuable to say his definition of an institution is the means by which we transport culture across time and geography. And then he said, culture means that which is real, right, and valuable to any group of people. They have consensus about it. Then he said, amongst Gaudiya Vaishnavas, we have two institutions, the hard institution and the soft institution. And he said, of the two, the soft institution is more effective than the hard institution. And what is the soft institution? It's the Gaudiya literatures. Mm-hmm. And so then he shows how the Gaudiya literatures are the most proficient at transporting culture across time and geography. And if you interview devotees in any country who've come to Krishna consciousness, you'll find that somehow or other the culture had touched them because they read the book. Mm-hmm. It's there inside the book. So the strategy of book distribution is sound. And it's one that was noted by Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Bhaktivinoda Thakur, by our founder Charya A.C. Bhaktivinoda Swami Prabhupada, who really pushed it as a strategy. And you can look at the opposite. When despots want to restrict the free flow of thought or any particular ideology, then they ban your book, they censor it, or they, you know, there are even cases, book burning, some places, some tyrants, you know, they'll take the books and burn them all in a bonfire just to make a point that, you know, we don't want you thinking anything else. But if one book gets in, group of people at a house can start looking at it and go like, hey, this makes sense, and it's in a book. And then the next thing you know, it's like, this is what we're going to do now. You know, it's like, bring the other guys over. Let's have a look at it. It's like, we got this book. You know, they start going through it and go like, well, that even happened in the former Soviet Union. A few books leaked in there because books are sneaky too. I mean, that's one of the ways they transport culture across time and geography. You can't really stop them. It's really hard to stop books from getting in places. So they're very subversive in that way. You know, the book gets out, and it's like, where are they? It's like, we don't know. One of them got in. It's like, oh, no. In the right environment, one book can conflagrate. It can cause, you know, a revolution of thought. Because living entities in a particular environment, when they're starving for information, and they get it, the kind that they were looking for, it can't be held back. And Victor Hugo said that the most powerful force in the world is an idea whose time has come. And we saw in the former Soviet Union, when people got a hold of these books, you know, they just devoured them. And so, you know, the idea is also, at a particular time, we may not see people devouring our books. But they're out there. And when the time comes, when there's a shift in the overall mood of the society, and there may be, you know, things might be harder to get, and like freedom could be restricted this way or that, or anything can happen, then those books are there for people. They're actually there. Preservation through mass distribution and education. We want to get the books out there so that they're planted. They're seeds. They grow. And they grow at different paces according to the environment that they land in. Nary a book goes in vain. There's not one book that goes in vain that's distributed. And as far as an engagement for devotees, it's a very high sadhana. Because it requires that somebody has to operate at a very high level in order to open the hearts and minds of others. One has to have kind of a spiritual power that you can only get from chanting good rounds and dancing in Artik. And when you have that, you know, then you know, you can be effective. And when you don't have it, then you'll try harder for it so that you can be effective. And those two things balance each other out. And you can go a whole lifetime balancing these two things together and just growing stronger and stronger in the practice of your bhakti. So from all points of view, the book is really the thing that humans admire most in society. We want knowledge. We want something that's aesthetically beautiful, and that's in books. And most particularly the Srimad Bhagavatam. It has everything. It has all the aesthetic beauty that the soul desires. It has the perfect philosophy. That last year, we sat in Govardhan during Kartik, and we read 5 hours a day. The last 3 or 4 days, we read 7 hours a day because we were trying to finish the fourth canto. We started with this ambitious project. We're going to read the whole third canto. We finished the third canto enough time to be like, we said, okay, now let's try the fourth. I don't know, I got to leave in a week. So 7 hours a day. You know? And when the devotees heard what's in there, we were just listening. They were transformed, changed, right? He was there. And you walk out and you look at the world and go like, oh my God, why didn't I think of this before? I mean, it's all in there. Even one devotee, you know, he said, what was I thinking? After he heard the whole thing, like, it's a complete shift in consciousness when one hears the Srimad Bhagavatam. So this trouble that we're going to maintain, you know, an organization, stay spiritually fit, and then go out to give it to others. This mission is very well founded, and the process of book distribution is it's not only practical and strategically sound, but it's also very pleasing to the heart. We love our books. I mean, who would want to live in a house that didn't have a set of Prabhupada's books? I was once invited to a lunch in Vrindavan. There's somebody, come over, we're having lunch at such and such. I was like, all right, we'll go over. And on the way over, they were talking about, well, what's this person into? It was like, I don't know, it's kind of weird, and you know, this and that. And I get there, and they go, can I have a book? Because we're waiting for lunch. And they go, they don't keep Prabhupada's books here. I said, I got to go, I got a stomachache. I mean, I was polite about it, but I didn't feel like staying. I didn't want to eat what they had to offer me at that place. They knew Gaudiya Vaishnavism enough to have Prabhupada's books, and they just didn't have them. And I didn't feel it was a hospitable environment enough. And so this is what we love. This is what we do. This is what feeds us. So it's a very practical thing.
If it's important, how important it is that for us to have this knowledge, is there a way for us to have books like where we'd be able to be free at times, to devotees who would really be interested in the books, since it's so...
To read them, you mean?
Huh?
To read?
Yeah.
Today? We have from 11 till 12:30, we're going to be reading the Bhagavatam in there. And
I mean, when
from 2 to 4, we're going to read another 2 hours.
When they're distributing, for people who really, I've seen like there are instances where people come up and they really want one book, and they might have to get the whole set.
We had Rath Yatra the other day in San Francisco. We got these golden book stands for the Bhagavad Purnima.
Yeah.
And they're really beautiful. I was surprised how nice they are. And so we had those on the table, and we had Bhagavatam sets. So the Bhagavatam is $250. With the stand, it's $300. So people came over and they said, how much is the stand? Malini said, it's $300. They said, $300. They said, yeah, it comes with the book. And they go, all right, we'll take it. One of the stands. Well, we have to accommodate people in whatever way we can. So the devotees are always thinking, like, how to make the books available in combinations that, you know, people can take them and understand them and appreciate them.
I was just wondering, because I saw, like, I was out there a few times where I saw, you know, I don't know, devotees of, you know, of Krishna consciousness, but they're really interested in certain books. And they wasn't able to grab that book. you know, because they have to get the whole set, and they just wanted a particular book, I guess, just to read, and any knowledge on the learning about God would be great, I assume. You know, yeah. You know, I don't know how they go about getting that book, just that one if they want it. Just being
talk to Gopal, he can arrange anything. Krishna conscious, we have to be a little self-forgiving sometimes too. I mean, you know, we bring so many, you know, it's a pretty clunky existence. We've caught on to, you know, so many different kinds of natures because of our association, not just in this life, but previous lives. So it's not so reasonable to think that, you know, all of a sudden we'll be the perfectly refined in all aspects. And, you know, Krishna talks about this in the Gita. He says, apichat sudaracharo bhajate mama mandibha. Sudaracharo means, like, really being influenced by your worldly side. He said, but if you're trying in Krishna consciousness, then that worldly side, it's not really that important, because it will be overcome by Krishna's influence. So, I mean, that's one aspect of it, is don't freak out. They'll freak out that, you know, it's like I'm not perfect, or I don't have, you know, all good qualities and things like that. You know, because that can also become an anartha also, that I can't be self-forgiving. And then on the other side, you know, we can be very deliberate about trying to amend the ways in which we do our services. And, you know, it says in the Shastra that if you perform devotional service, then you'll naturally develop good qualities. So someone then might say, well, then I won't try to develop good qualities, I'll just keep doing devotional service. By that logic, you might also say, I won't take a bath because, you know, I mean, why should I do anything for that matter? But, you know, we do take a bath to stay clean. And similarly, you know, we can very deliberately try to work on certain kinds of bad habits that we might have. Like if somebody had a habit of procrastination, you could study ways to overcome procrastination, so you could make your service to Krishna more efficient. You know, just be deliberate about it. But it requires a little detachment also, because you know, one way or another, we'll get knocked around, either internally or externally, by the environment that we're in. So, you know, one of my favorite purports in the Bhagavatam is, again, to the verse I mentioned earlier, Tatteya Anukampam. It's 10.14.8. And there, Sridhar Swami says, the great Bhagavatam commentator, that the main purpose of the devotees is somehow or other stay alive in Krishna consciousness. Because, and he compares it to the son of a rich man. He says, by the law of primogeniture, that the son will inherit the wealth, and therefore, he says, he has one duty. Somehow or other, stay alive. Because when the father dies, he'll pass on everything. So we have to be a little inventive and somehow or other stay alive in Krishna consciousness. And just one other point on this. There's a verse, again, Krishna giving encouragement, where he says, the verse starts off, Ajata Shrada Makatasu Nirvina Sarvakarmasu Veda Vika Makam Kamas Prityagi Yanishvara Pyanishvara. He says that a devotee may be disgusted with the material world, including his or her own nature, and want to change everything, and knows that sense gratification leads to misery, and then doesn't have the power to actually execute that yet. So then Krishna goes on to say, know that you're on the right path. You can be a little remorseful that you're in that position, but don't become pathologically morose and then give up your service. But go on and, you know, have faith that by staying as steady as you can now and continuing with your service, then Krishna will give you all facility. And you'll be fine.
I have one question for you. In your book, you write about, you're reading from it, exclusive dependence on Krishna, and how in the early days when the book distribution started, devotees wanted to experience exclusive dependence, so they got onto a van with no money and anything, they just started driving up.
Yeah.
You all really liked it, like, this is really cool. But I was just trying to figure out in my head, like, how it's a really, like the idea of exclusive dependence on Krishna, and how to, I was wondering, like, you're planning, managing, organizing, at the same time to experience exclusive dependence.
Yeah, but those aren't mutually exclusive. The fact that Krishna gives you the wherewithal to plan and manage and do all those things, that's also Krishna. Mm-hmm. And that's also depending on Krishna. Yeah. Somebody sends you a marketer, for instance, and you know, she says, okay, do these kinds of things. That's also Krishna's energy. So we're depending on those kinds of things also in the spirit of Yukta Vairagya. And just because in the early days we didn't have those facilities and nobody, you know, thought to employ them, we had a whole different mindset back then. We never paid for anything. We'd always, you know, if we had to go to a show to, you know, do a concert or something like that, we'd climb the wall before we'd hand over money for a ticket. You know, like, it didn't really make rational sense. Like, hey, look, it's $5. You're going to make, you know, $200. You know, just pay the ticket and go in. You know, so, no way. Climbing the wall. Just because devotees were more, it was a matter of principle. And because of that matter of principle, they were more desperate. It doesn't mean that we should do that now. You know, you know, if Krishna's given us facility, we should take advantage of it, you know, and use it, you know, to expand. You know, it's like with technology. My philosophy is if it's worth speaking, it's worth broadcasting. And so, you know, everything should be recorded, broadcast, and if it's not worth speaking, why are you saying it anyway? I mean, there's certain private things you might say, but we use all technology to, and why have a funky, you know, broadcasting system if you can have the topmost in the world? Mm. I mean, why do the radio stations get the best, you know, kind of equipment? We should have the best equipment because we got the best information. You know, why should we be back in the dark ages and think it's okay to have broken microphones and, you know, the speaker system doesn't work, or, you know, we don't have a camera here, or whatever it is. You know, we should take the best of everything, and that's depending on Krishna. Mm-hmm. The spirit of it, right?
Okay. I was thinking.
But the other part is there too, you know, that no matter what we do, ultimately it all depends on Krishna. Ashaudi chintayat Vishnu. There's a verse in the Ayurveda that says even when you're taking the best of medicine, you still have to pray to Vishnu. Because it won't work if he's not going to make it work.
The verse you read from Bhagavad Gita, you said that reading the purport that one should work without consideration of defeat or hopelessness. And I was just wondering, when things are put in front of you that can make you feel hopeless or defeated, or, you know, you read, even today's verse was talking about how one who has this independent issue of, like, mentality, they can't understand Krishna. And here and then I'm thinking, well, I have this mentality so strongly, so then I can't understand Krishna. So how do you, when those, like, anarthas in the heart are brought to, like, the forefront, how do you not feel discouraged, or how do you remain, I guess, encouraged?
You know, in any journey, if you don't know where the ending point is, you're going to be discouraged. Like somebody tells you to do as many push-ups as you can right now, and they don't give an ending point. Depending on how strong you are, you know, you'll get to 5, 10, whatever it is, and then you go, can I stop now? But if someone says, you do 11, and, you know, I'll give you a sandesh, you know. then it's like, okay, I'll do this, you know, because you know what the end is. So with the nartas, if we think these will be here forever, they'll never go away, then we can become discouraged. We right to be disappointed. But there's a beginning and an end to it. There's a process that we're going through, and at some point, the anartas will diminish, and they won't be there anymore. In fact, the station of nishta bhakti, means that you've overcome 5 basic anartas that are naturally there in the heart of somebody who's been associated with the material world, hanging out here a little too long. You know, it's just there. But the process of bhakti, nashta prayeshu bhadrishu nityam bhagavata sevaya, will dissolve those in due course of time. So knowing that, having faith in that, you continue with the process and go on. And you may say, well, it's not happening fast enough. Well, then take a little more medicine. You can double the dose. Because oftentimes, you know, I'm just like an inch away from, making some breakthroughs and stuff. So have faith in the medicine and keep taking it. And it will work. And you can see from the examples of other people who are, you know, a little further along taking the medicine. That's why we have to have association to have that conviction and faith. Yeah.
And you have time for the program?
Yeah, we'll just take one more question,
thank
then we got to
so
go.
Can I just ask one question? Again, you mentioned about association, and Prabhu mentioned about association in this class. And I was just wondering, reflecting on myself, I feel like I'm very awkward. I don't know how to associate with devotees, and I'm working. And I read that in Nectar Instruction, Prabhupada, on I think the verse 3, he said that this is actually the way that, you know, devotees should associate with one another. There's an exchange of love, you know, like giving prasadam, getting prasadam. And then on one topic, he said, like, revealing confidentially and receiving conditionally. But sometimes, what are the topics that's considered in that sense? That, like, sometimes we just, like, engage in loose talks and stuff like that. And I want to make sure that, you know, I'm, like, behaving in a way that is, like, helping other devotees, you know, and myself, that is, you know, progressing in Krishna consciousness and not like away from Krishna, like, you know,
And or I like my position of being advanced.
Nacharyar Marman, Nacharyar Marman, Nacharyar Marman, Nacharyar Marman, hey, Nacharyar Marman, Nacharyar Marman, Nacharyar Marman, Nacharyar Marman.